Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's program, we feature a conversation with Lisa Kimmerer, who's a professor of philosophy and religions at Montana State University. We'll be talking about the environment. But first, here's some news.
From One Green Planet, cows and bulls are exploited by humans in horrendous ways, whether it be in the meat and dairy industries, the leather and skins industry, or in bullfighting and rodeo rings. These gentle giants are treated as mere commodities rather than living, breathing creatures who feel pain and fear. A recent incident that involved the horrific abuse of a bull occurred in a small town just outside of Valencia, Spain. After being forced to participate in a Running of the Bulls event earlier that day, a bull was tied to a post and placed in an arena in front of a roaring crowd as flaming torches were tied to his horns. Naturally, the bull became alarmed, fearful, and confused, and he instinctively reacted by attempting to run away. In the nightmarish frenzy, the poor animal ran headfirst into the pole he was tied to and died instantly. A petition addressed to the Spanish government has been made demanding an end to this cruel practice that exploits bulls for entertainment and harms them in brutal ways. If you agree that this type of event must be banned, please take a moment to sign the petition at onegreenplanet.com.
The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia has sided with the Humane Society of the United States and other animal protection groups that ruled that federal protections for wolves under the Endangered Species Act should be maintained for the 4,000 or so wolves inhabiting the northern forests of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. This ruling is a very significant win for conservation, the integrity of the Endangered Species Act, and for the wolves. On August the 1st, the U.S. Court of Appeals, in a unanimous ruling of the three-judge panel, affirmed a U.S. District Court ruling from 2014 in favor of wolf protection. The ruling brought about an abrupt halt to the inhumane trophy hunting and commercial trapping programs in those three states. Some lawmakers in Congress from states inhabited by wolves have been trying to strip away endangered species protection for wolves. Cattle ranchers have an irrational hatred of wolves, fearing wolves will attack their cattle, even though more cattle are killed by domestic dogs than by wolves. Deer hunters want wolves gone to ensure more deers to be hunted. Sport and trophy hunting programs targeting wolves are an anachronism, are anti-ecological, and diminish the economic health of regions with meaningful wolf populations. Wolves provide a wide range of ecological and economic services. They act as a firewall against the spread of chronic wasting disease, which has had a devastating economic impact in southern Wisconsin, where there are no wolves left. Wolves reduce densities of white-tailed deer, which in turn protects commercial forestry operations and agricultural crops by reducing deer overgrazing. And by reducing deer densities, wolves can also help to mitigate the risk of vehicle-deer collisions. In short, wolves can benefit agriculture, public safety, forest and water quality, and ecosystem health. We're very glad that the U.S. Court of Appeals kept USA protections for wolves.
Recently, the Center for Biological Diversity sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over its program allowing the export of tens of thousands of wild animals trapped and killed for the international fur trade. The service's program covers five fur-bearing species, including bobcats, river otters, wolves, lynx, and brown bears, representing the deaths of about 80,000 individual animals annually in recent years. According to a spokesperson for the Center of Biological Diversity's International Program, the United States exports a shocking number of animals trapped and killed for their fur each year. Trapping for the highly lucrative international fur trade is just plain cruel and reduces local populations of bobcats, river otters, lynx, and other wildlife. The international fur market has boomed in recent years, largely driven by demand in China, Russia, and Europe, and resulted in the increased killing and export of the fur-bearing animals from the United States. Pelt prices for bobcats, wildcats sought after for their beautiful gray-brown coats, rose from about $85 in 2000 to a high of nearly $590 in 2013. The number of bobcat pelts exported from the U.S. roughly quadrupled during this time, peaking at a high of about 65,000 skins exported commercially in 2013. In addition to bobcats, more than 33,000 river otter pelts were also exported from 40 different states, and more than 3,000 lynx pelt were exported from Alaska in recent years. Gray wolves are also hunted, trapped, and exported from Montana and Alaska, as are brown bears from Alaska. Because these five fur bearer species are protected under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, a treaty governing trade in imperiled wildlife, export from the United States must be strictly regulated. However, trapping exceeds sustainable levels in some regions, and removing massive numbers of these top predators has a ripple effect throughout the ecosystem. An unquantified number of foxes, beavers, and other species also die in traps set for these fur bearer species. The Center of Biological Diversity's lawsuit targets the Fish and Wildlife Service for failing to fully consider all the environmental effects of its fur bearer export program, including at the state and local levels where wildlife impacts are most significant. Ultimately, the suit seeks to improve the U.S. export program and reduce the number of animals killed and exported for their fur. To learn more, go to biologicaldiversity.org.
Stay with us. Coming up next on Animal Concerns of Texas, we feature a conversation with Lisa Kilmer, professor of philosophy and religions at Montana State University. Lisa is known for her work for animal rights and liberation, where she works largely at the crossroads between speciesism and other social justice issues, feminism, heterosexism, and classism. She has nearly 100 publications in articles, journals, and encyclopedia entries, and she's the author or editor of 9 books. Stay with us. Lisa Kimmerer is next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Lisa Kimmerer. Thanks for with us, Lisa.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be back. You all are wonderful for doing what you do.
Thanks, Lisa. And can you tell our listeners a little bit again about how you got involved in animal issues?
Oh, it feels so long ago. I'm not sure I can, but see if I try to recall way back. I think, like many would say, I was born. I was born to be an activist. I was born caring. I remember incidents of being a child and the pain that I felt at what other kids were doing, and they knew it, and they would do it to pick on me. So, yeah, it was in there early on. I got a good taste of who humans were before I even knew it was happening.
And whereabouts did you grow up?
Washington State, rurally up kind of near the Canadian border.
And then you've traveled the world and seen abuse in many other countries besides the United States.
It's true. And it's awful everywhere. People have, you know, I want to say that in some ways it's like India has better legislation. And I've actually done some activism with people in India, and they actually have laws that will back you instead of here where the laws actively fight against everything we're doing.
Yeah.
And I think that's the roots in the Hindu tradition, in that sense of ahimsa.
Right.
Yeah.
It's nice when you see so many developments outside of the U.S., but we can't help to wonder ourselves, why are we falling behind, you know, other countries too? Israel and parts of Europe are much more advanced than us.
Yeah, it's our capitalism and the fact that money rules everything. Nothing else really matters to us.
You know, speaking of the world, this planet should not be called Earth. It should be called water because...
You're so right. That is awesome.
Most of the surface of our planet is covered by water. And
70% of it.
We've done terrible things to it in the last century.
Yes, we have.
Both the freshwater and the oceans are really being aggressively assaulted by human activities at this point.
Did you see the latest report about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, Lisa?
Yes, I did. And the fact that now, because of pig farming and Tyson, we have the largest dead zone in the world.
Uh-huh.
And I was always kind of surprised that we didn't, but I don't need to be surprised anymore.
A dead zone is an area where the oxygen has been depleted out of the water because of pollutants dumped into the ocean, and no marine life can survive. I just read this morning there's approximately 400 dead zones around the world.
Yes, yes. And this has shot up. If you look at a scale, if you look back, 40 years, say, there were almost no dead zones, and they came intermittently. And so it's an exponential. It's that swing straight up in the graph. And this is from factory farming. It is not from any other industry. It's because of these rich pollutants. So the manure goes into the water. It causes an algae bloom. The algae bloom dies. And when it dies, it takes up all the oxygen, and nothing can live in those waters. And you can see it from the sky. You can see the waters that are polluted with these nutrients coming down rivers. Oh, it's horrible to see. And when you think of all the life, 90% of all habitable spaces in the ocean and 80% of all life, so we are destroying, it's the largest wilderness on Earth, and we can't see it, right? We look out and we say, oh, isn't the ocean lovely?
Mm-hmm.
Or the solution to pollution is dilution, and the ocean is so large that you can just dump whatever in there and it will be diluted to a point where it won't have an impact. Well, I think we're way beyond that point now.
It's so true.
The problem is we've treated the ocean as both a toilet and a supermarket.
Yeah.
And that's a really bad idea.
That is awesome. You are right on with that. That is exactly right. Toilet and a pantry.
Well, Lisa, that's, dead zones is one of the many things that you discuss in your book, Eating Earth. And you talk a fair amount, too, about the silent collapse of the ocean ecosystems. Why do you think it's, we should call it, or why is it called a silent collapse? Why do you think people aren't really aware of what's happening?
Because we aren't fish and we aren't sea life, and that's the only reason. So we can't really see it. We can't feel it the way we can when it's on land, because we live on land. It's really no different. They're screaming down under just as long and loud in their own ways, but we are not under, so we don't know.
Well, and also people choose not to see things that they don't want to as well, I think, because I know when I first became on my path to being vegetarian and then vegan, one of the first things that moved me in that direction was watching shrimp harvesting in Oregon, off the coast of Oregon, where I was going to graduate school, and just seeing all the bycatch and the waste of that industry. Today, when I see people eating shrimp, I just want to cringe and tell them what they've done to so many other species that were just living their life, and then they're just like bycatch. They just die for cat food or whatever they use bycatch for.
A lot of it they just throw back in the ocean.
That's right.
Yeah, and if I were going to say, I think there's two main reasons. I think one is that we don't live in the sea, and it isn't just that we can't see them. It's that they're not furry and big-eyed, and they don't have hands. They don't even have paws. They can't reach out to us. They're different enough to us that we don't relate.
Right.
And I think the second reason that we've lost 90% of our large predator fish, and that's the destruction of ecosystems across the board. And that's, I think, partly, too, because of what you mentioned, this bycatch, the fact that the only methods we have for fishing are methods that catch everything. I mean, it'd be like having a slaughterhouse where you had – fishing would be like installing a life magnet in slaughterhouses and killing whatever was sucked in, sparrows and voles and dogs and possums. And fishing's like that because you use hooks and nets and you can't control what goes into them.
Yeah, it is a really shocking way in which if you see those aerial views of those giant trawlers that are like having nets that are like the size of 5 football fields, just taking up whatever they can get from the sea, it is horrifying.
And the bycatch includes birds and
turtles.
Dolphins and turtles, yeah.
Endangered species, right? 4.4 million seabirds, marine mammals, sharks, turtles are lost every year, and that's just along lines. And some of our most endangered sea life, we know specifically, like the vaquita, right? It is the nets, it's the gill nets. We know exactly what it is, and they are very likely to go extinct because we're not willing to do what it takes to stop the gill nets from being in the area where they live.
I read this morning that 3 out of 7 people in the world depend on seafood as their main source of protein.
Right.
That's incredible, and it's also very sad that we're depleting the ocean.
Yes, depleting. We have depleted. We have had to go to deep sea fish because they're gone at the surface level, and that, when you think of indigenous peoples, That's what they depend on. And in the book Eating Earth that this comes from that I put together, I don't know, I think it came out in 2015, its tagline is Environmental Ethics and Dietary Choice. And I'm very clear that I am talking to people who have choices. So we have choices. And when we continue to do what we're doing, we're making it so that people who don't have choices won't have anything to eat. And while I don't like the fishes being eaten, it's not for me to say that anyone should have to starve rather than eat what it is that's available to them.
Right. That's a good point. And you know, I wanted to go back to one of the things that we just talked about, too, is the sympathetic nature of fish and sea life and how people just don't bond with them. But I like in your book how you also point out that, you know, by eating seafood, we're taking food away from sea lions and harbor seals,
yes,
and brown bears,
yes,
and bald eagles. And those are the animals that, you know, people can identify better with. And so I thought that was nice that you connected the dots.
And at the same time, we're blaming the seals for destroying the fish that we,
yes,
want,
right,
for,
right,
ourselves.
Yes.
And so we're killing the seals.
Yes. When I worked very, very briefly for 1 week on a fishing boat when I was very young, that was something I noticed is that, first of all, I noticed that birds came up on the lines. We were doing long line fishing. And the second thing I noticed was that the guy that ran the boat, which was called the Silver Quest, he would shoot anything he saw that would eat fish. And
wow,
boy, I got off that boat as soon as I got to the next port. I was so poor. I had nothing, but I was not willing to work on that fishing boat, whatever it took. I was happy to go back to, I basically was living on someone else's boat, needing peanut butter and bread because I didn't have anything, but it was not worth it. And, you know, I think it's really important to talk about we need to recognize that all the ecosystems are interconnected,
yeah,
so that when we do deplete our seas, there are so many animals that even people are indifferent, like bears, obviously.
Yeah,
they require those salmon runs. Those ecosystems are interconnected.
It's a web of life, and when you start unraveling one or two threads, the whole thing collapses.
Yes.
And I guess one of the other, you know, going back to the issue of pollution, you know, mercury is also a big problem. And, you know, my wife had something I thought fairly intelligent to say recently where she said, you know, why are we're telling pregnant women not to eat fish. So shouldn't that raise a red flag for the rest of us?
Yes. And that is something that I also cover in the book. I think it's important. So there's not only that, not only should we, mercury has it's like a no tolerance zone. There's no levels of mercury that we should have. And if you're eating fish, you're getting mercury. And again, I point to the indigenous people, and it's indigenous women in communities that have fish that are most affected by the fact that we have polluted our seas, so that, again, we can say there's another reason not to eat fish, but there's some people that don't have that option.
Right.
And isn't mercury a byproduct of coal mining?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And doesn't the White House resident want to increase coal mining?
Are we avoiding the name? Yes.
The resident.
There is no such thing as clean coal. I live in Montana. I know it. There's coal industries here. And I see the coal going by in trains. I know what it's doing. And I wish they'd put a big old coal plant right in Trump's backyard so he can see what that's like.
Yeah, no, it is. It's just very shocking when you do see. And I mean, we've known that we've been fishing down the food web since the 1980s. I remember,
yes,
reading a paper in Science Magazine, the premier journal of, you know, scientists in America, and there was already an article then saying that we had already made the commercial fisheries unsustainable for the fish that we traditionally eat. And at that time, we were eating, quote, bait fish instead. And that now even the bait fish are in collapse.
Yes.
And it's just we've known it for like 20 years, and yet people just keep eating and leaving nothing behind for all the other life in the sea. It's just tragic when you see those pictures of starving polar bears. And
yes.
And it's sad that so many semi-vegetarians, pesco-vegetarians, eat fish because, you know, they think, oh, the fish are nothing like us. And I have to admit, seafood was one of the last things I gave up when I went vegetarian and vegan.
And I don't think it's because they're thinking that the fish is nothing like us. I think they're just selfish and they're worried. They somehow have been convinced they need to eat fish for their health.
Yeah, to get their
omega-3s.
Yeah, omega-3s.
Yes, that's right. You have some walnuts. Go for some flaxseed.
Yeah, that's right.
You know? And anyway, you're not going to live forever, and you're not the most important thing on this planet.
I think that's where the issue comes in right there.
So I'm wondering, too, one thing that I'm not amongst other things I'm very educated upon is aquaculture and sort of these factory farming ventures for the fishing industry. How exactly do they operate?
All right, so that's a really important subject. Before I go to that, I want to comment first on something that Liz said. She mentioned that we've known about this from the 80s. Actually, in the 1970s, we started doing the deep sea fish because we had depleted the ones that were near the surface. And so in doing that, we were going to fish that we actually can't even see what we're doing. These are fish that live below where we can do counts. We have no way of assessing the damage we're doing. God, you know, we're bringing in things with names we've never heard of, The onion-eyed grenadier, spiny-tailed skate, right? The blue hake, spiny eel. Who's heard of them? But they're coming up on our plates, and they're from the deep seas, and who knows what we're doing down there?
You know, I've read that a lot of them are mislabeled as orange roughy and other things.
Yeah, well, they absolutely. So this is another thing. Sustainable fish. This is another thing that we hear that we need to know how to reply to. Studies show that the things labeled sustainable are at least a third of the time they're wrong, and they are often endangered species, and some of them are mislabeled 90% of the time, and these are studies that show this. So there's nothing sustainable about these so-called sustainable fish.
And then the aquaculture industry is just horrifically polluting, just like any factory farm, because the animals are kept in very small confined spaces and fed
right in the ocean.
Yeah, or in the ocean. Yeah, I saw a captive tuna ranch when I was down in Mexico one time doing something off the coast of Mexico. I was kind of shocked, and they told me that's what it was.
Right. And, when we think about the aquacultures, the factory fishes, it's a good time to remember that really, it isn't just about the ecosystems, that this is how we need to talk to environmentalists to get them to understand that they need to stop what they're doing. But at the end of the day, every fish matters, and that those factory farm fishes are kept and treated very much like the factory farmed land animals, and it's not okay.
And people might think that because fish are raised on fish farms, they might even contain less mercury and less pollutants.
No.
But in fact, they have just as much, and they're also fed a lot of antibiotics.
Yes. So they pollute the waters around them through antibiotics and what they're fed. So they're affecting the ecosystems, and many of them are just kept in pens in the ocean. So they affect fishes around them. So there's a couple other things that go with that. So one is the predator control that we talk about with land animals, where they're killing the predators to protect the, the ranchers' interests.
Uh-huh.
They do the same thing for the fishers' interests. So they're killing, seals and otters and bears and whatever shows up there in the places where they live. And, of course, the other really scary thing is that you can count on it. The fish escape, and they know they do. And they are pumped up with antibiotics, and they have diseases, and those spread to the wild fishes, and they interbreed with the wild fishes. But there's one other thing I want to mention, and that's that if you are factory fishing things like salmon, they eat fish. It's a net loss.
Yeah, that's a good point. They just go out and get more fish. Same thing with tuna, right? They have to go in. They have to provide them with fish to eat. They're not going to eat, cat food or something.
And what it often does is it gives a way to get money for bycatch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lisa, one of the things you also talk about in your book, Eating Earth, is the whole issue of hunting. And I know that's a difficult one, especially here in Texas. And people have a deer lease, and they feel like it's the ethical and the best thing that they can do to help conserve the species and things like that. I'd love to hear your thoughts on, maybe a snippet on some of the issues that you go to in the book about hunting.
Yeah, this topic drives me wild because it's another one. It's like fishing. We really aren't informed on it to respond to the nonsense that we hear. And pretty much everyone hears that the hunters are the conservationists. And what this comes from is history, that it was the hunters that depleted the species. So they were the ones who, in the early 20th century, they were the ones who got together and decided, here's the legislation we're going to make. We're going to get an excise tax on guns, and the hunters are going to pay for it. And through that, we're going to fund fish and game. And that's how fish and game got started. So it was designed because of hunters for hunters. So that's the fish and game that we've inherited. But of course, and so they were funding the conservation. But of course, conservation is by and about and for, it's all about humanity. And then in the 1970s, they actually didn't have enough hunters anymore, so they put an excise tax on handguns 10%. So we know now, and this is at least half the guns are handguns now. So hunters are not even paying for the fish and game system that they set up that favors them. So it is nonsense for them to say that they are the ones that are doing the conservation. Mm-hmm. They're not. And they also, of course, wish with fish and game and that whole fact that they feel funded by hunters, they are manipulating wildlife, which means basically, read, destroying ecosystems.
So no money from their fees is going to protect wildlife. And also, the fees that are raised from hunters isn't even enough to pay the salaries of the employees at the fish and game agencies.
That is correct, that they are money deficient. But remember to be careful when you say the word protect, right, in quotes, protect wildlife, because, right, they have the things called the refuge, where you feel like, oh, they're going to be protected.
Yeah, refuge.
All they're doing is making sure that there's plenty of huntable species, and it's at the expense of other species, and then they say, oh, look, they're overpopulated. We have to shoot them. We're doing it for them,
right?
So, it's just nonsense. It's nonsense on steroids.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest challenges, too, is breaking this misconception of fair chase, or, you know, that it's this, that somehow this is some fair battle between man and beast, or however they try and phrase it.
Yeah, the very notion that anything could be fair between a hunter and a duck, right? We have this idea of fair where naturally, you know, you're both in on what's going on and, you know, there's some equality between the two of you, right? And there's not even a chase. So not only is it not fair, the other one's not armed, doesn't know what's going on, doesn't want to have anything to do with this so-called sport. And then there's nothing equal about it, and there's no chase, right? If a deer runs, give it up. You're not going to get them. So you have to sneak up on them. So it's more like an ambush, right? It's a slaughter from behind a bush. Why don't they call these things what they are?
It's true.
Yeah, I agree completely. And Lisa, we're going to have you come back on a future show to discuss this in more detail, since we're kind of running short on time here.
We've been talking with Lisa Kemmerer, professor of philosophy and religions at Montana State University in Billings. Lisa, can you tell our listeners where to go to find out more about your work and the books you've authored?
Yes, there's two on environment. One of them is called Animals and Environment. It covers all these subjects and so much more about how you want to talk to environmentalists to bring them on board with the things that matter for animals. And the other one is called Eating Earth. You can find about them on my website, which is lisakemmerer.com. You can get a hold of me on Facebook or on my webpage. There's also an email, and I love to be in touch with people who are working on these issues.
Well, great. Thanks so much, Lisa.
Thank you so much. You all are awesome. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, you too.
If you'd like to learn about another aspect of veganism and a plant-based diet, join the Vegetarian Society of El Paso for the Summer Dinner and a Movie. The movie being featured is What the Health. It's Saturday, August 26th at the Radisson El Paso Airport. You need to make your reservations in advance, though. The deadline is Tuesday, August 22nd.
You can make your reservations online at vsep.org, or you can call 877-3030. And go to the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org to learn about the many other activities going on with us.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Linney.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the Earth, the Animals, and a Healthier Humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.